Hello, Susanna Lopez here, actor turned barrister turned broadcaster turned true crime writer and proud member of Sisters in Crime Australia. Welcome to the Scarlet Stiletto Bites podcast. For over 30 years now, Sisters in Crime Australia has supported our women crime writers, both true crime and fiction, and some criminal literary talent has been unearthed. Among many awards, there's an annual prize for short crime fiction, the Scarlet Stiletto Awards. And for those of you who prefer your stories by ear, in 2023 we commenced this podcast series, Scarlet Stiletto Bites, to celebrate the sisters' 30th anniversary. Each story is short, but not always sweet. Expect twisted tales, quirky humour, and a frisson of feminism. Please support us by following, sharing, reviewing, and generally spreading the word. We have no paywall. Many people seem to think that most crime happens in urban sin cities. Today's story challenges that view. Silk versus Sierra by Sandy Wallace. Best Investigative Award, Scarlet Stilettos 2013. Shit, she cursed when her hip vibrated. Not now. Nearly all the 450 permanent residents in town had her mobile number, and hubby Steve's too. But they never rang on Wednesdays simply to chat. Barb's rest days were no-fly zones except in emergencies, doubly so during karaoke time every second week. She took the call outside. A minute later, she rushed in. Babysitter? Work. Steve screwed up his nose. Take the car. I'll grab a lift if you don't make it back. Wait up for me. Barb kissed him full-lipped. We're definitely having our nookie while the kids are at Sal's. You betcha, babe. She departed, feeling a cocktail of emotion. First a dash of disappointment at missing karaoke, followed by the chance to defend her gumboot-throwing title, if anyone was dumb enough to take her on. Topped with apprehension, excitement, and curiosity. By the time she donned her uniform and nosed the marked four-wheel drive down Seacombe Road, she'd lost 8 or 9 precious minutes, yet compared to the 40 to 60 minute response time from other available units, this was speedy. Still, she chafed at the delay. She trusted her information implicitly. Not much went past certain characters in this town. In fact, the same old fella who'd called in tonight's factory alarm had been her first customer in Locksport. Her transfer came through quicker than the sale of the house in Mitcham. And she'd started the family sea change alone. She'd been unpacking and answered a rap at the door. A short, leathered bloke with baby's fluff hair stared at her.
Len Brown, he announced. Just to let you know, this is the police house you've broken into. The police are on their way.
She'd barked out a surprised laugh and asked him to cancel his call. He did, after she'd proved she actually was their new officer in charge, a.k.a. the only police officer in town. Now, based on Len's call, she knew an alarm was going silently crazy. Whether it proved to be a non-event or break-in, she'd ascertain in roughly 1 minute. As it had cost her the chance to sing Billy Idol's White Wedding, she somewhat hoped for the latter. Barb slowed after the golf club and pulled right into Progress Road. The truck's tyres scrunched on sand blown from the road verge. The town's industrial estate consisted of two handfuls of large blocks bound by high cyclone wire fences, a deterrent against ruse rather than burglars. Several properties were perpetually for sale, as was about a third of the town.
Between faded for sale signs, vacant land, and junk strewn across the yards of tin sheds, just as neglected, the street wore an abandoned appearance. And set amongst all this were a few structures that Barb suspected acted as registered addresses for dodgy companies. Number 7, LS Mining, was one of those on her fishy list, and its silent blue alarm flashed through the darkness. But Barb's eyes were drawn to the steel-grey Commodore on the driveway, parked at an angle, bonnet to the street, both front doors sat ajar. Which first? Check the factory or car? Instinct told her the car. Coppers don't like to enter dark warehouses. Too many mock shootouts at the academy were probably to blame. Besides, the car was closer and might hold the culprits who had set off the alarm. Barb left the red and blue strobes on and took her keys as she exited the truck. Some wags had taken her vehicle for a spin the one time she chanced leaving the keys in the ignition. No harm done on that occasion, except to her pride. She'd never repeat the mistake. She extracted the mag light from her belt and shone it over the vehicle. With boots barely making a sound in the black sand dubbed soil, she approached. The sedan's interior light illuminated what appeared to be an empty cabin. She reached the car, confirmed front and back seats were vacant. Barb's heartbeat moderated a smidgen. Towards the rear quarter on the driver's side, she noticed a large ding with red paint transfer and shattered taillight. She arced the torch as she walked along the passenger side and caught sight of a transformer toy on the ground, about half a metre away. Barb squatted next to it. The bumblebee Autobot looked chewed and knocked about. A twin for her 5-year-old Angers, except for its decapitation. Transformers survive tough love, so it must have taken something like an adult's weight to break it. Still thinking about the toy, she took in sticky smears on the passenger door trim and crumbs scattered over the seat. Definite kid territory. Her stomach flipped. Where was the kid now? Ange would never abandon one of her beloved toys, squashed or not. What had prevented the kid from rescuing the Autobot? Barb touched the bonnet. Hot. She snatched away her palm. Another quarter circle and she swept the torch over the cockpit again, although from the driver's side. The cup holders in the centre console contained a half-empty bag of jelly snakes and Audrey Hepburn sunglasses. She leaned to examine dry splotches on the charcoal carpet, then squinted at a stain on the grey leather seat. Blood? She straightened. Should she find the boot release and search the storage space? Or skip to the factory to ascertain what had happened there and if her car occupants were inside? A screech made her head rip sideways towards the end of the street, which terminated at the tip entrance. She saw a car fishtail and skew into a fence, caving in 10 metres of chain-link wire. The car shot past so close to the Commodore that the driver's door rocked on its hinges and Barb's shirt flapped against her flank. Immediately she retrieved her truck, took pursuit and called in the chase. In pursuit of red Audi, Europlate, Victor, Sierra, Lima, Kilo, 1-1. Barb swiped a trickle of sweat that blurred her eyes as she gave D24 particulars of her location. Also run a plate check on abandoned Commodore. Both are connected with my potential burg at Progress Road. Sierra Tango Yankee 338. All police vehicles were kitted out for officers to run their own checks, but Barb couldn't manage that and a high-speed chase along the Seacombe roadway. The sole road out of town was fairly straight, but too rugged for this type of speed. The truck jumped as it hit potholes, and Barb gripped the wheel harder. Update speed, please. She glimpsed the speedo. 140. Meanwhile, the Audi increased its lead. Barb compressed the accelerator. Her pulse galloped. The truck was no sports car, and she strained to manage it at 165 clicks. She sent a silent prayer. Please, God, don't let a roo jump out in front of me. ETA on backup? No available units in your vicinity. Minimum 55 minutes. No surprise, I'm on my own. A crackle interrupted her thoughts. Then, road conditions and current speed? Clear, dry, just me and the suspect vehicle. Dark, potholed, ruse lurking in the scrub near the road. Current speed, 170. A rattle came from near the tailgate. Barb tensed. At this speed, it wouldn't take much to flip the truck. Her palms dampened, but she ignored it. Confirm that. Continue to monitor and update. Note, suspect Audi, Victor Sierra Lima Kilo 11, registered to Vincent Silk, South Melbourne. Barb shook her head and stared through the windscreen at the ever-increasing gap between her and the luxury sedan. So, VSLK was an acronym of the owner's name. That made his faux Euro plates doubly pretentious. What brought you from the big smoke to my town, Silk? The radio crackled again. Commodore Sierra Tango Yankee 338, registered to TR Auto Repairs, also South Melbourne. Barb pondered on the commercially registered car. It didn't tell her much, except that both vehicles were a long way from home and definitely connected. Either vehicle reported stolen. Negative. Not stolen, or the owners hadn't realised. Tell me, Sierra, what are you doing here along with your mate, Silk? Except that Silk and Sierra weren't mates if the dinged rear end of the Commodore came courtesy of one red Audi. The Audi put on another burst and Barb flattened her foot. The speedo shot upwards. At 210, she radioed through. Current speed 210 and suspect vehicle well ahead. It's unsafe to proceed. I'm calling off the chase. She hated doing it, but another vehicle could enter the road from one of the tracks. She couldn't risk it and had buckles of catching the car in this heap anyway. The truck suited the more sedate pace of Locke Sport's typical police jobs. Drunks, domestics, collisions, community meetings, along with occasional natural and accidental fatalities, firebugs and wildlife euthanasia duties. Barb pulled a U-turn. She headed back to deal with the dumped Commodore and factory break-in and radioed through an addendum, a KALOF requesting local units keep a lookout for the Audi. Next, she speed-dialed a number on her phone. On your way home, babe? Oh, could be a long one, love. Anything I can do? Oh, keep that twinkle in your eye for later. She heard Steve's chuckle as they disconnected. Barb left on bells and whistles while she returned to Progress Road under a safer speed. The truck's headlights cut through the darkness as she cornered and flicked off the siren. She braked at the spot she'd parked earlier. The blue light outside the factory still pulsed. All was the same as before, sans one vital item, the grey Commodore. Barb jumped down from the truck and slammed the door. The sound cracked in the night and a startled mob of roos bound away to feed elsewhere. A flash of the torch revealed the beheaded transformer and near it some fresh scuffs in the sandy dirt, but no clue as to the whereabouts of the car. Barb straightened and pinned her eyes on Factory 7. At least she could deal with that alarm. Easy said, yet every sense worked overtime as she edged toward the shed. Her left hand operated the maglite,
Her dominant right was free and she used it to push the access door open wide enough to slip through. The same hand reverted to hover over her service weapon. Police! Anyone here? She strained, but heard nothing. At the luminous panel near the entrance, Barb checked her notebook and plugged in 4 digits. The screen flashed to alarm off. In this isolated district, private security and or Barb attended emergencies such as tonight's, and the non-resident owners of LS Mining had entrusted her with key and alarm code rather than old Snowy in his battered panel van. She'd met a petite bottle blonde who was purportedly one of the directors just once for the code and key handover, and right now she couldn't recall much about the woman, except that she'd been overdressed for the remote beach town in a white pantsuit and blingy sunglasses. Until now, Barb hadn't been inside this factory, and she'd always held suspicions about what, if anything, went on here, particularly when Blondie gave her a Melbourne business hours only emergency contact number. Apparently her intuition hadn't corroded from 6 years of one-member station policing. A flick of the switch shunted the tin shed into bright light. It was an empty shell, cobwebbed and dusty. Curtains over the tiny window stunk of mildew. The place looked undisturbed for years, except for 2 parallel stripes through the dust on the concrete floor and a greasy oil patch between them. Barb strained her eyes. She squatted and scanned. Make that 2 tire tracks, an oil patch and a bunch of shoe prints. Several were pint-sized prints, which made her anxious. She mentally listed everything since her first arrival at the factory and jumped when her portable radio squawked with an update on her KALOF. Rosedale and Sale units reports 0 sighting of suspect Audi. She shrugged. Well, Silk could have taken the Seacombe route rather than heading up the Longford Road. Or he was yet to come into the range of other cars. Or he's doubled back. She shivered despite the muggy night. Her mind twisted to the vanished Commodore, perhaps with an injured driver and child in the midst of all this, and Barb felt a stir of urgency, less common these days than during her previous suburban postings. Whatever was going down, she wanted it sorted, fast and without casualties. After she'd secured the factory, she added the Commodore to the KALOF, then dug out her mobile and dashed to the police truck. "Steve," she said when her hubby picked up, "keep an eye out for 2 out-of-town cars, a steel-grey Commodore around a 2004 model and a new red Audi. Both are sedans." She quoted the rego numbers and added, "Let me know if you see either, but don't get involved. The occupants could be dangerous, or in danger, I don't know which." She called off after assuring him she'd be careful and made a succession of similar requests to the CFA captain, Snowy, Jill at the Marina Hotel, and Len. The small town grapevine would do the rest, and soon hundreds of extra eyes would be on the lookout. After she'd turned over the truck engine, Barb hesitated. The blood and sticky food crumbs in Sierra's car had her worried. Sweat puddled between her boobs. Uneasy and pumped, her nerves buzzed. She tamped down the emotions and reasoned through the case. Somehow, Sierra knew the LS Mining factory was vacant. However, that was no state secret. Every local had that knowledge and could have passed it on. What puzzled her more was that someone, Sierra, triggered the alarm after they'd been parked inside the building. Well, that didn't make sense. Unless, say, they'd deliberately set it off to enlist help. Her help. Think. Fast. The truck's motor vibrated through the steering wheel. Barb itched to plant her foot, but forced herself to pause and process the situation. She presumed Sierra was on the run with a young kid and came to this factory for refuge. And that was after Sierra sustained an injury and bled on the carpet and seat. Silk, the driver of the Audi, somehow followed / found them here, and at some stage the cars clashed. Sierra and child were hiding when Barb arrived, and Silk took off in a hurry, but could be on his way back. Barb's brow puckered and she shook her head. An elaborate scenario, but is it pure fiction? She flicked her thumbnail against her front teeth. Tap, tap. Her next headshake was decisive. Both mum and cop radar combined into certainty. She couldn't explain or dismiss it. If she wasn't spot on, she'd struck bloody close. Now she drove. Barb turned left toward town because the other option overwhelmed her. Numerous tracks came off Seacombe Road, and a lone cop couldn't quickly inspect them all. She followed Lake Victoria at a slow pace and scanned continuously. Meanwhile, a follow-up plate check on both vehicles revealed neither reported stolen so far. As she crawled through town, it crossed her mind that Sierra mightn't be a thief or connected with the auto repair shop. She, remember the Audrey Hepburn Sunnies, may have borrowed a friend's vehicle to get away from Silk. That'd explain the lack of booster seat for the kid. Could this be a case of domestic violence and an ugly custody dispute? Yes. Frequently, the basic theory was spot on. Take that double homicide in Natty Yallock, where the killer was allegedly the son of one of the victims and motivated by money. It was a tragedy, yet a too common scenario. Barb noted Curtin's twitch as she moved along Victoria Street. She cut across to National Park Road and near the swamp, hooked around onto Toorak Avenue to again hug the Lake Victoria side. It'd be unlikely that Sierra or Silk would stay on the more conspicuous main drag that dissected town. A couple of fellas from the CFA stood on the nature strip ahead. She pulled abreast and dropped her window. I said keep a lookout, but don't be too obvious or get involved. Ring me if you see something. She shooed them inside and they chuckled, yet complied. Barb swatted a mozzie, then another, but she did it unconsciously. Her mind was fixated on the tango between Sierra and Silk. She couldn't abide an outcome similar to the Natty Yallock case. Shit, idiot. She reached for her phone. Her hubby wasn't just a full-time Mr. Mum. He was also a home-based IT whiz. Can you run a search on LS Mining? Oh, hi, honey. I missed you too, Steve retorted. Sorry, love. Thank God we don't have to sweet-talk D24. Same. Now, can you look at the directors and their addresses, please? She heard Steve click away, punctuated by rustle sounds from his shirt against the receiver. Soon he said, two directors, Vincent Silk. Ah, of course it is. He quoted a South Melbourne address. And Juliet. Shit, that's it, Barb thumped her forehead. What's it? Blondie was a Juliet, but she never gave her surname. Huh? I'll explain later. Now, more about the meeting with the woman from LS Mining came back to Barb. Juliet had deftly sidestepped questions, and somehow they'd ended up talking about their kids, our four girls and Juliet's boy, who's the same age as little Ange. Although he still sounded perplexed, Steve confirmed. Her surname's Silk too. Same address. Bloody hell. She'd wasted precious time at the factory before she'd called around for help. Anything could have happened in the meantime. She rang off and resumed her trawl. Then her phone and radio went berserk. From all over came reports of the Commodore or Audi's current location. Except that it was impossible for the Commodore to be in Cliff and Snipe Streets simultaneously, just as the Audi couldn't be near the caravan park, whilst it was supposedly 30 metres ahead of Barb's truck. In their excitement to help, the locals' imaginations had gone wild. Fortunately, the flurry settled, which allowed Barb to concentrate. She must back herself. If she lacked the wits to solve situations alone, she'd never have secured what was traditionally a male job, the run of a one-member station in an isolated seaside country town. She'd jumped through hoops to prove her aptitude, and the quirky, sleepy place hadn't extinguished her ability, although she'd seemingly surface rusted in the salty air. Notwithstanding the invitation to Mozzie, she left the window open and edged the truck forward. The wind was up again. Trees and shrubs swayed in a haphazard swirl with loud whooshes and whistles. In the distance, waves crashed on the surf beach. Barb had to picture herself as Sierra, Juliet. She hypothesized aloud. I'm on the run from hubby Vincent with our son. I borrowed a friend's car and came here to our empty factory. I hid the car in the factory, thought we were in the clear, pulled the car out and spotted Vincent's Audi. I dragged my son back to the shed, accidentally squashed his toy, triggered the alarm and locked us inside. Someone would let the cops know. It's the type of place that things are noticed. But I hoped it'd be sooner than later, because Vincent's angry. He hit me earlier and I bled on the car upholstery. Barb could smell her own sweat. If she got this wrong, Juliet and her son were in grave danger. She went back to her reckonings. Luckily, Vincent didn't have a key to the shed, and a cop arrived before he broke in. We came out when she chased Vincent off. And went where? Barb crossed National Park Road again into Wallaby Street. The baked mud mixed with fart smell from Lake Reeve when it dried up over summer struck her, along with a rush of adrenaline. Steve may be Mr. Mum in their household, but Barb was hands-on too. Where would she take their kids to keep them safe? Somewhere secluded, and preferably with a toilet, because God knows kids always need to go at the worst possible times. The national park would tempt her, but its corrugated dirt road and dead end held less appeal than the surf beach, with its slightly better access options. She steered over the causeway and the crash of surf amplified. Her high beam picked up a squashed bunny on the bitumen. Blood still wet and sticky, the carcass not yet picked over. Recent roadkill. Run over by Juliet? Or Silk? Maybe. Barb circled the truck into the beach car park. Her hands tingled when she spotted the grey Commodore parked in the darkest corner. The red Audi angled behind it, obstructing escape. Barb parked, blocking the Audi, and checked both vehicles before she paused and listened. All she could hear was the pound of surf, but instinctively she knew where they were. Urgency made her sprint. She drew her torch. Her booted feet burrowed into loose, deep sand as she ran down the hill. Moonlight glistened on the foamy waves in the horizon, but her eyes fixed on the three sets of footprints in the wet sand edging the water. ragged tracks of mid-sized, pint-sized and large footprints led into just mid and large treads. She imagined Juliet had snatched up her child and held him as she raced with her husband in pursuit. Barb clicked the maglite's high beam and held it overhead. She accelerated, huffing heavily as she preferred Sudoku and fishing to athletics. Now she heard shouts over the surf. Her light picked up a cluster, shapes refined as she approached. She saw the petite blonde she recognised as Juliet scuffle with a hulking male. He struck her backhanded and she sprawled. Barb's "Stop! Police!" went unheeded. A tiny boy cowered before the man. His eyes seemed too large for his face, wide with fear and shock. "If I can't have you and my boy, no one will." Barb swallowed bile, mixed with the chicken parma she'd had for tea at the RSL. She had never understood the mentality that killing someone you loved was better than letting them go. Silk hoisted his son like a sack of potatoes and spun to the sea. The boy lifted his chin and pierced Barb with ebony eyes. He stretched his fingers towards her and whimpered. "Stop!" Barb repeated. Silk half-turned, snarled, then trotted into the lacy threads of retreating breakers. One glance at Juliet assured Barb she was conscious and safe for now, unlike her son. "Let him go!" Silk ignored her. Barb tried again, wishing she knew the child's name to make her plea more personal. "Silk, let your son go!" He ran on. Taser and gun were both too risky with the child in close proximity. Oh, what should I do? A primal mothering reaction overrode cop protocol. Barb roared and charged at the man. Silk's trousered legs plunged into the waves. The boy screamed. Barb knew the seafloor dropped steeply. In a few more steps, Silk and his son would submerge and be sucked into the rip. As her boots struck water and sank into the shifting sand, she assessed her rival. Her solidly built 5'8" meant she was no pushover, but Silk topped 6'4" with the bone structure and muscle tone to suit. Waves slapped her calves. No time to hesitate. She lunged forward. She grabbed Silk's collar and yanked him down to her height, and she clenched a fist. One chance is all she'd get. Crunch! Her knuckles connected with his temple. He grunted. His eyes widened, then blanked. His body slackened and the boy splashed into the water. Barb threw an arm each around the father and son. The little boy struggled. "It's okay, mate." Barb tried to soothe him, but more frightened than ever, he bucked, pitching her into the water. Still clinging to the man and boy, a swallow of seawater made her gag and spit. She managed to drag them onto the beach and collapsed to the sand. Her lungs burned and salt stung her eyes. The boy scurried to Juliet, who drew him onto her lap. She cried loudly, her tears dropping onto his wet curls. The boy clung to his mother, and Barb saw his body quake. Silk lay on the beach. His gaze travelled over his estranged family and then to Barb, who scrambled to her feet, weighed down by her waterlogged uniform. He looked back to mother and son. His fingers spasmed and face contorted. Barb felt a prick of compassion. Strangely, she heard Billy Idol accompanied by the surf. "There's nothing fair in this world." Her heart hardened to Silk. "Nothing safe in this world." What Silk had attempted in a warped sense of love was the ultimate betrayal of the purest thing in his world, his son. Barb nudged Silk with her toe. "Hard," he yelped. "Too late for regrets." His eyes squeezed shut in mute response and she glanced back to the boy. He'd pulled away from his mother to stare at Barb. salt water and tears beaded on his face, and with his eyes still fixed on her, he crept a thumb into his mouth. Barb checked on Silk. The fight had gone out of him. If it weren't for his heaving chest, he'd pass for dead. Oh, he'd keep for a moment. Yet she kept her body angled and alert whilst she inched towards the child.
"Hiya, little fella. Well done for being very brave." She gently shook the boy's tiny hand. "I'm Barb. What's your name?"
He slipped his thumb out just enough to mumble,
"Oliver."
"Hiya, Oliver." Barb maintained eye contact with the little boy, but directed her next question to his mother.
"Are you both okay for now, Juliet?"
Juliet screamed in the instant that Barb sensed movement behind her. She sidestepped and pivoted a second too late. Silk punched her jaw. Her head snapped back. Her brain rattled as she reeled onto the sand. She gasped. The bastard had to be stopped. In a beat, she'd regained her footing, although her eyesight fuzzed. She shook off the sensation, but her reactions were sluggish. She had no hope of stopping Silk from pushing his wife. Juliet flew and crashed into the shallows of the greedy whitecaps. Barb was torn. Assist Juliet or protect Oliver and apprehend the husband? Peripherally, she saw the woman stir, thrash and crawl to safety. At the same time, Silk grabbed for his son. Oliver's squeal stabbed at Barb's heart. She saw him duck and writhe to avoid his father.
"Stop! Let him go!"
The two women screamed at Silk. His face split into an ugly smirk, but his eyes were more chilling, black pits of spite. He snagged Oliver by the collar, although the child struggled. Juliet sprang from the sand and wrapped her arms around Silk's neck. He flicked her off. Oliver squealed again. Barb launched at Silk, but Juliet somehow beat her and connected a fist onto her husband's nose.
"Bitch!"
Silk sliced her hand backward at Juliet. A sickening snap cut through the sound of the surf. He kicked Barb squarely in the chest and her breath whooshed. She bit the inside of her cheek and tasted blood, then hit the ground again, winded again. She took a mouthful of sand, coughed and spat. Grains crunched between her teeth as she lurched to her feet. What she saw merged fear into fury. Silk had sprinted up the beach, making for the ramp to the car park. He held Oliver's hands in one of his own and dragged him. The boy's body bounced and swung. He cried out, a sound of pure terror. Juliet hauled herself up. She cradled her jaw and swayed, in no shape to pursue her long-legged husband. Silk had a massive head start, and Barb knew she couldn't run him down before he reached his Audi and rammed one or both of the other vehicles. He'd escape with poor Oliver, and God knows what he'd do to the child in a fit of malice.
"Stop him, please!"
But Barb was already in action. She ripped off one steel cap and staggered in an uneven gait. She blocked the terrible sight of Oliver rebounding behind his father. She focused her mind and eye, with torch centered at the back of Silk's head. 1, 2, 3. The boot flew. She held her breath and followed its sweep. A millisecond after it struck Silk's skull, his knees buckled and he slumped head first into the sand. Oliver sprawled next to his father, too frightened or hurt to move. Barb surged onwards, wet clothes, 10 kilograms of equipment, belt and one bootless foot made the distance of 50 meters a marathon. 10 meters away, Silk appeared motionless. 2 meters from his body, Barb spotted what resembled the muscle spasms of roadkill. But she went on high alert. Silk wouldn't get the better of her again. She landed with a knee to his lumbar. Air burst from his lungs.
Barb snapped his wrists into handcuffs, then checked his vitals and rolled him into the recovery position. Still watchful, she hunched and panted. Thin arms fastened onto her mid-wheeze. She froze, then inhaled carefully. When that didn't frighten Oliver, she stroked his hands in rhythm with her breathing. With each stroke, his trembling reduced, finally stopping when his mother joined their huddle.
"And that's why you're the reigning gumboot-throwing champion."
"Steve?" Her hubby pulled her into a hug. She dug her fingers into his back and inhaled his musky scent. Then, over his shoulder, Barb saw a contingent of townsfolk traipse down the sandy ramp. Wrinkly Ralph, a fisherman who virtually lived on the beach and probably instigated a phone tree, with his mate Len, followed by a motley crew of those born and bred in Locksport, alongside sea changers and greenies. Although just a tad slow to arrive, the sight of her weird and wonderful neighbours moistened Barb's eyes. She chuckled and locked lips with Steve. The end. And apologies for my slightly distorted voice for this narration. I just had some dental surgery, and it's made my voice a little less clear than usual. Thanks so much for listening. We'd love to get your feedback, and we'd love to reach more listeners. Our website is sistersincrime.org.au, and our email address is admin@sistersincrime.org.au. Until next Friday, then, when we bring you another scintillating story from Australian women crime creative.